Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, you can go to the events page, and you can see where the events are happening in 2020. We've got two city events coming. We got one in Chad's great state of Texas, down there in Houston, not too far from him. This is the kind of city event that Chad didn't even have to fly to. He's just going to get in that car and drive, I think. I think that's what we're going to do.
We're taking the Silverado down there.
Driving that truck down there to Houston. I'm going to be there. Chad, obviously, going to be there. Matt Popovich, Gretchen Ronovich, Loso. Scott Keith, you want to be there. We're going to be talking about what happens when people encounter Jesus. It's free. It's February 22nd. Just go over to the events page. You can sign up for free. We'd love to see you there. Also, we're going to be in Las Vegas on March 21st. I'll be there. Eric Sorensen, Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, Cindy Koch, and Blake Flatley. We're going to be talking about the book of Galatians. Six chapters, six speakers. It's going to be great. How jam-packed is that going to be? All killer. No filler on that thing. Every person has to talk about a chapter. Come and learn about Galatians and Sin City. That's also free. You can sign up. Please do so. We'd love to see you. Chad, got to give a big thank you to all the people who helped support us on Giving Tuesday.
Yeah, a big, big thank you, man. That was awesome. That turned out spectacular.
Yeah, we reached our goal, exceeded our goal. So thank you so much to those of you who chipped in. And hey, if you haven't and you wanted to, you know, it's still the end of the year, and we're still trying to get everything ready for 2020, and we're still trying to raise funds. So if you want to join up with us, you can still do that by going over to the donate page and doing that. But thank you so much to those of you who made Giving Tuesday a success. We did hit the goal that we set for that one day. It kept us on track for where we wanted to be at the end of the year. That is due to you, and thank you so much for making all of this stuff possible. All right, Chad, where are we at in the Gospel according to Joshua?
Yeah, we're entering into, I mentioned this last time, we're entering into a section that's, we're going to move pretty fast, let me put it that way. We got a lot of division of land. We got a lot of place names in these chapters, let's put it that way. So, We're going to touch on a few matters in at least chapter 14 and 15. We'll see about the other chapters, but this is going to take us like through chapter around 19, the division of the land. So we will move as rapidly as we can through that so we can get kind of to the end of the book and spend some time on those last couple chapters. So anyway, we're in 14 right now, and going to talk a little bit about Mr. Caleb in chapter 14. So we started with the division of the land in chapter 13, and that's where we had the 2.5 tribes mentioned that we've discussed multiple times, receiving their inheritance on the eastern side of the Jordan. Now we're going to shift gears in chapter 14 to a focus upon where Caleb is going to receive his inheritance, and we're going to hear a little bit about him. And I want to talk about something in relationship to Caleb that I don't think that we have touched on before, and that is his family tree. Because as it turns out, Caleb actually comes from a non-Israelite family when you go back a couple generations. So I don't think we've talked about that before, so we'll discuss that. Anyway, once we finish chapter 14, we'll jump into 15. And 15 is all about the division of the land for the tribe of Judah. So I want to talk just in kind of big terms about the place of Judah as a tribe in the history of Israel. Just kind of give us I know for some people it might be a little bit of review, but I want to try and give kind of the big picture of where Judah fits in to the broader biblical story, and then specifically why that tribe is so significant as it relates to the Messiah. That's 14 to 15, and beginning with 16, we have 16 through 19, we have a discussion of how the various other tribes received their inheritance. So that's what's coming up. Jump back to the beginning of 14, and this is what we hear. This is kind of the introduction to this whole section. Now, these are the territories which the sons of Israel inherited in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest, You remember that he inherited the high priesthood, Eleazar did, and Joshua, the son of Nun, and the heads of the households of the tribes of the Israelites, apportioned to them for an inheritance by the lot of their inheritance, as the Lord commanded through Moses for the 9 and a half tribe. So, you know, this is kind of confusing to some people when you start adding up the tribes, because you have you have 13 tribes, basically, the way this is divvied up instead of 12. Because what happened with Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, his inheritance was split between those two. They were sort of adopted as the sons of Jacob. So you have Ephraim, Manasseh, kind of Joseph himself split into two tribes. But the tribe of Levi doesn't receive an inheritance except the cities. And so it ends up where 12 tribes receive their portions. And then this other tribe, the Levites, they only receive the cities. So if you're ever confused, it was like you start adding up and you're like, "What? Wait, it looks like there's 13. Well, that's because Joseph was split in two between his two sons. And that's how you have this division. So anyway, you got the 9 and a half tribe mentioned here in verse 2. So this is the way they did it. They got everybody involved. Joshua, he's the leader of the Israelites, of course. You got Eleazar, so he's the high priest. He's another one of the leaders. And then you have these representatives from all these households, the heads of all the households of the Israelites. And they start casting lots and dividing everything up. And we've had this before, already back in the Torah, the discussion of where these particular tribes are going to receive their land, kind of scattered throughout the Holy Land. So then it goes on, verse 3, for Moses to give any inheritance of the two tribes and the half tribe beyond the Jordan, but he did not give an inheritance to the Levites among them. All this is just rehearsing what we've covered. For the sons of Joseph were two tribes. This is what I was just discussing, Manasseh and Ephraim. And they did not give a portion to the Levites in the land except cities to live in and their pasture lands. Okay, so that's all just kind of pulling together what we've discussed and explained many times before. Now, before he gets into the major divisions, he's going to spend the rest of the chapter, verses 6 through 15, talking about one particular individual and how he is going to get his land and why he gets his land. And this individual we're talking about is Caleb. So we met Caleb way back, right? Caleb was one of the 12 guys that Moses selected as spies to send across the Jordan to check out the land. And of course, they all came back with the initial report that, yeah, everything is so awesome there. I mean, you got this fruit everywhere. Everything just looks fantastic. Except 10 of them went on to say, but there's no way we can do it because we're going to get killed. Because, you know, we look around, everybody has fortified cities. We compare our size to them. We were like grasshoppers. You got these sons of the Anakim, the sons of Anak, these giants there. So we just can't do it. And of course, that was the beginning of their 40 years of wandering in the desert. But we met Caleb back then, and of course, Joshua. They were the two spies who said, no, we can do this. God's on our side. And they tried to get the people to follow them, to heed their advice, to trust in God's word, but to no avail. So they were the only two adults, 20 years old or over, who made it all 40 years and were allowed to cross into the promised land. So we've heard plenty about Joshua. This whole book is even named after him, but we haven't heard as much about Caleb. Well, now we're going to kind of get back to Caleb, and he's a pretty cool guy. I mean, it's you look at the Old Testament, and there's plenty of people who you're like, just kind of shake your head, like, my God, this guy, so many problems, so many issues, so many just screw ups right after the other. But there are a few guys. You look at him, you're like, yeah, you know, I like this guy. And he kind of seems to have his act together. Well, Caleb is one of those rare specimens in the Old Testament who to me anyway, seems to be like that. And I guess one of the reasons I appreciate this particular part of the story so much too is because he is old. He's 85 when all this happens. So it's not like you got some young guy, he's like 25 and he's like, as we'll hear in a minute, he's like, yeah, give me that land because there's a bunch of big guys there. And I'm going to go in and I'm going to kick their butts and I'm going to drive them out of their cities and I'm going to take over that land from them. This guy's 85 years old. So anyway, that's kind of setting up what's about to be said. Okay, so let's just kind of go through it and then we'll discuss the details. So the sons of Judah, so the tribe of Judah, they come to Joshua in Gilgal, and Caleb, who is described as the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite. We're going to come back to that in just a minute. So that's his dad, is Jephunneh or Jephunneh, however you want to say that. And he's described as a Kenizzite. Okay. So they say to Joshua, you know, or Caleb says to Joshua, you know the word which the Lord spoke to Moses, the man of God, concerning you and me in Kadesh Barnea. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. And I brought word back to him as it was in my heart. Nevertheless, my brethren who went up with me made the heart of the people melt with fear. But I followed the Lord, my God, fully. So what happened? Well, Moses swore on that day, saying, surely the land on which your foot has trodden shall be an inheritance to you and to your children forever, because you have followed the Lord, my God, fully. And now, look, the Lord has let me live, just as he spoke, these 45 years from the time that the Lord spoke this word to Moses when Israel walked in the wilderness. And now behold, I'm 85 years old today. I love this, verse 11. I am still as strong today as I was in the day Moses sent me. As my strength was then, so my strength is now, for war and for going out and for coming in. So what does he want to do? Well, verse 12 tells us, now then, give me this hill country about which the Lord spoke on that day, for you heard on that day that Anakim, those are the giants, Anakim were there with great fortified cities. Perhaps the Lord will be with me, and I shall drive them out as the Lord has spoken. So this big, long speech that Caleb gives, and there's only three verses left. Here's what Joshua says. Joshua blessed him and gave Hebron to Caleb for an inheritance, and therefore Hebron became the inheritance of Caleb until this day, because he followed the Lord, God of Israel, fully. And then it ends with this verse. Now, the name of Hebron was formerly Kiriath Arba, for Arba was the greatest man among the Anakim. Then the land had rest from war. What do you think of Caleb?
Caleb, it reminds me of, this a while back, that somebody asked Michael Jordan, who's now like 50, if he could still dunk, and he was like extremely insulted. and he says, what kind of question is that? And I'm thinking, I don't know, it seems like a reasonable question. This is what this reminds me of. Like, Caleb's like, I'm exactly as good as I've ever been.
That is just exactly the way it is. Verse 11. Hey, I'm still as strong today as I was in the day Moses sent me. I don't know of any 85-year-olds who would make that boast, but Caleb does. I'm just as good now as I used to be.
Yeah, that's and you might think like, oh, he's maybe talking about like, I'm as strong in the faith as I ever have been.
Yeah,
but that's not what he says. Like, I'm as strong for fighting. I'm as strong for everything.
Yeah, whatever you need me for, I'm good. You know, I've kept up a healthy diet. I go to Gold's Gym. Yeah. Yeah. Avoid bad habits. So. No, I mean, I really think this is it's sort of his implicit way, I think, of giving praise to God, right? Because, I mean, he earlier says, the Lord has kept me alive all these years. And I think it's more than like, yeah, I've still got a, you know, beating heart and breathing lungs. I think he's kind of saying God has done more than just kept me alive. He's kind of kept me vivacious, I suppose. He's kept me in very good shape, and I'm ready to rock and roll still.
It's pretty good.
So, yeah. So anyway, Caleb is it's kind of hard not to admire somebody like Caleb. But I mean, he's got a long history here. So I was trying to figure up here the years. So if he was 40 when Moses sent him in to spy out the land. That means he was probably about 38, I guess, when they left Egypt, because it was about a 2-year period between when they, you know, crossed the Red Sea, they journeyed through the wilderness, they stay at Sinai forever, like over a year, and then they have to go from there to the Holy Land. So he was about 38. Then he's 40 when he goes in as a spy, and then, you know, for the next 40 years he has to walk around and wait for his whole generation to die off. And now here they are. And for the last few years, they've been doing all these conquests. And we've mentioned this before, you know, it seems as if this is sort of a blitzkrieg, right? Israel goes in and just beats everybody up, wins almost every battle. And it all happens within a matter of weeks. Well, no, it's not the way it happens. I mean, this is sort of telescoped here, this whole account. It makes it seem as if it happened really fast, but it didn't. It took some time, 5 to 7 years, we'll say, that they've been waging these battles and conquering cities and doing everything they've been doing. So Caleb has been a very busy man leading his people these last few years. But he's not done yet. I mean, when I'm 85, if God gives me that length of life, I'm probably not going to be volunteering for military service or for a whole lot of other things. I might surprise myself, but I don't really see that happening. But he's like, give me a challenge. I want a challenge. Dude, you know, I'm not just saying, give me a place with like a lot of fig trees and some really good land. I'm going to build a house and I'm just going to settle down there and bounce my grandkids on my knees. No, he's like, you know where I want to go? That hill country where all those giants still are. That's what I want.
Dude, I'm 39, and if they were like, let's go fight the Russians, I'd be like, that sounds like a young man's game. I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm 39 years old, man. I can't do that. Like, I can't be running around.
I'll serve as their counselor.
Yeah, I can't go around. I can't go fight anyone.
I'll give advice. Yeah, so here we are with Mr. 85-year-old Caleb wanting to lead his people into battle. You know, I can't. And this kind of gets back to something I was alluding to earlier. I wonder, and this is nothing but pure speculation, but I wonder if part of the reason that Caleb is the way he is because he kind of comes from, it's almost, well, I don't want to say he wants to prove himself, but, you know, if someone is an outsider and they come in, there is sort of this idea that they're going to make sure by the efforts that they put forth that everybody knows that they're part of the team. You know, they are fully in to whatever this endeavor is. And I wonder if maybe part of that might be Caleb's motivation, because here's what I was going to get to earlier. So Caleb comes from a family, a tribe, a people known as the Kenizzites. It's kind of a strange word, Kenizzite. And we don't know hardly anything about who the Kenizzites were, except this. So the only other mention of them, not in connection with Joshua, not in connection with Caleb, because there's plenty of references of the Kenizzites in connection with Caleb. But the only other mention of them is back in, turn to it now, Genesis chapter 15. Of course, Genesis 15, that's still in Abraham's day. And listen to these couple of verses. This is from Genesis 15, 18, and 19. So we might have talked about this, but this is the lost episode. For those of you who are new listeners, we were talking about this the other day. There is an infamous lost episode early in the days, in the youthful days of 40 minutes in the Old Testament.
Indeed.
We actually recorded it.
Yep.
And then something just...
It got corrupted. The file was corrupted. It got taken down. And then we didn't have the original. And it's just gone forever.
Yeah. So if you're listening to 40... Like if you're... like a lot of people have done. You know, they start listening when we're in Exodus or Deuteronomy, or even now, and they're like, hey, you know, I kind of like this thing. I think I'm going to go back to the beginning. This is, lots of people have done this. And they start listening Genesis 1 onward. And they'll get to a certain, you know what the, you know which one it was?
It is episode 21.
Okay. So they'll get to 20 and they're like, all right. And they look for episode 21 and it's not there. That is the lost episode. And I'm pretty sure that lost episode was when we talked about the smoking oven that passed through the sacrifices.
And it's no big deal.
No, it's no big deal. I mean, yeah, it's not like it was corrupted because we, you know, were spouting heresy during that particular episode or something. Was that
it's only one of the most important events in the entire life of Abraham. It's fine.
Yeah. No big deal. Well, maybe one of these days we'll come back to. But anyway, all that as a preface to what I was about to say. So this is 15, 18, and 19. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants, I have given this land from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. The Kenite and the Kenizzite and the Kadmonite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Rephaim and so on and so forth. So Genesis 15, 19 is the only other reference besides those specifically linked with Caleb to the Kenizzites, which means to me that at some point the family of Caleb basically became part of, like, were adopted by the tribe of Judah. So his family, when you go back a few generations, they came from a non-Abrahamic lineage, non-Israelites. And so they were basically converts to the faith of Abraham at some point. Now, we don't know when this happened. We have no idea because we're never told. But the fact that he is from the Kenizzites tells us that he is not a physical descendant of Abraham. And in a sort of ironic way, Caleb is entering now, or has entered these last 5 to 7 years, has entered into the land which originally was the location of his people. Now, we don't know where exactly the Kenizzites were located in Canaan, but we know they were there. And so now, in this kind of strange turn of events, Caleb, who's originally from, his family originally from Canaan, but who was brought into Israel, is now returning, and he is now in the covenant with God, receiving from God the land which he swore to Abraham. So it's kind of one of those God things, one of those strange turn of events that that God was able to bring about for Caleb. And so here he is, after all these years, about to enter in, and he's going to go into the hill country, which is where his foot trod, to use that language of the text, where he walked all those years before when he was spying out the land. So this is where he's going to be. And he says, the Anakim there, the people we've talked about many times, they have their fortified cities. And he's got this one word there which might, like, raise questions for people. It's the word perhaps. He says, now, verse 12, now then give me this whole country about which the Lord had spoken on that day. For you heard on that day that the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. Perhaps the Lord will be with me, and I shall drive them out just as the Lord has spoken. Now, don't make too much out of that particular word. The Hebrew there is often used as it's almost like a humble and hopeful expression. Caleb is not saying, I don't know, God might not be with me. I mean, I'm not sure. It's kind of a self-deprecating sort of way. Like it's not like a lack of trust. It's just an expression of humility. Perhaps the Lord will be with me and I shall drive them out just as the Lord has spoken. I mean, I guess you could kind of compare it to the Latin phrase Deo Volente, right? If God wills. I mean, I'm not saying that this is like a for sure thing, but if God wills it, perhaps, then the perhaps isn't that he's going to be with me, but I shall be able to drive out these giants.
Yeah, it's the difference between faith and presumption.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
I mean, yeah, there is a bad thing that happens in the realm of faith. We see this is pervasive, like where you just say, like, if I say this thing is going to happen, then it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So I say, well, I declare that Chad does not going to need glasses anymore. And because I believe it, then God has to do it. That's not faith. That's presumption. What Caleb is saying is that if God does go with him, then he's definitely going to win. Mm-hmm. He's not wondering if God goes with him, if he will. It'd be like me saying, if we did go pray for someone who was sick, we would say, perhaps God will heal him. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not doubting whether or not God can. We're just saying, perhaps it is in his will. And if it's in his will, it's definitely going to happen.
Yeah. You know, I think the biblical story I always go to, kind of along these same lines in this same discussion, is I was trying to find it here. Here it is. It's in Daniel. It's the famous story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego getting thrown into the fiery furnace, or right before they are thrown into the furnace. You know, of course, they're not going to bow down to this idol, the statue. And here's when Nebuchadnezzar basically says, well, if you don't, you know, I'm going to barbecue you. They say, this is Daniel 3:16 and following. Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, that's what I like, but even if he doesn't, let it be known to you that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. So you have this twofold answer, basically. Hey, God can deliver us, and he is very able to do that. But even if he doesn't, even if for whatever reason he doesn't do that, well, we're still going to do his will. And I mean, it's sort of like that here with Caleb. And I think it's just kind of a good model to follow. Yeah, I mean, you trust in the word of God to do what it says, but it's not like you're guaranteed 100% results with regard to your actions, even as you trust God to be faithful to his word.
Yeah, God always delivers you. He just doesn't always deliver you in the temporal sense.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes you get martyred.
Yes, this is true. Yeah. And when Paul says God causes all things to work together for the good of those who love him, it doesn't mean that we get always to see that either. So that's a good thing to keep in mind.
Yeah. Oh, well, Paul, this is why Paul can say to live is Christ and to die is gain.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I think they're similar in the sense that, I mean, God will deliver us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he might not deliver us from this. In fact, this might be our entrance into that final deliverance. That's the way he wants to do it, but he certainly can.
Yeah, so I think that's the way to view these. I mean, I like the way you put it. It's a matter of faith and not presumption.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you know this, Chad, but Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did, in fact, eventually die. So this is how this works. I mean, God, at some point, God doesn't deliver you from death.
Yes.
But the greater reality is that God always delivers you from death.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's why you have that kind of language in John, right? So I die, but I don't die, because if I'm in Christ, I don't die because I live in him. So yeah, I'm going to die, but I don't. Or like Paul says in Galatians, you know, I've already died with Christ, and so it's he who lives in me now.
Yeah, that final deliverance is the great reversal, where death becomes the doorway into eternal life. I mean, it's all backwards.
Yeah. Well, is it in 1 Corinthians where Paul says all things belong to us, and he has this list, and one of the things that's listed is death?
Yeah.
It's this strange notion that death now belongs to the Christian.
Yeah.
We don't belong to it. That's that other great reversal. It's not like we are slaves of death. No, quite the opposite. Actually, death becomes a slave to us. We own it, so that it has to serve us by, through death, delivering us into the kingdom.
Yeah, this is why, and this is, now we're like way off the beaten path here, but one of my favorite things that Jesus does all the time is where he refers to death as sleep. It's like he refuses to acknowledge its power, because he knows he's going to go strip it of all that power. So he'll walk some Lazarus or some kid that's dead, like, he's not dead, he's asleep. And I assure you, he's dead. But not to Jesus. Jesus is like, death, that's sleep to me.
Yeah. That's why I'll never forget this. I think I was at seminary. I was in a class, and I could be wrong here, but I think it was with William Weinrich. I believe he's the one who taught me this. I didn't realize it before. So for those of you listening who don't realize this, here you go. Here's a moment you realize it. That the Greek word behind the word that we get for cemetery means sleeping place.
Oh.
Yeah, so cool. So when you refer to the cemetery, the etymology of that is not like a place for the burial of the dead. The Greek behind our English word for cemetery is sleeping place. And it's just, so the very word cemetery is sort of it's a Christian theological statement. Because when we go to the cemetery, we're just like you were saying, oh, look at all these people, they're asleep.
Yeah.
they're just waiting to be woken up by that final trumpet blast and to have their bodies raised by Christ.
Yeah, this is why Paul borrows that language, or is it Luke? That's where he says that, you know, like 500 people saw Christ, right, you know, after his resurrection. And he says some of which are still alive and others who have fallen asleep.
Yeah.
In other words, they will be woken up.
Yeah. It's one of the, I don't know, for me, that's just one of the most beautiful parts of the Christian confession with regard to the last things is that, we all have this fear of death, but there's really no reason to have that fear because it's just like it's going to sleep.
It's good stuff.
I guess there's more we could say about chapter 14, but I think we pretty much covered everything in there. So let's move on. That's Mr. Caleb. And we got a few minutes here to talk about chapter 15. So I thought I'd take chapter 15 as a case, as a jumping off point to, as I mentioned earlier, to talk about the tribe of Judah, because all of chapter 15 is about the division of the land given to the tribe of Judah. Now, what's interesting about Judah is that early on, we saw this already in Genesis, right? Judah emerges as sort of the leader of the brothers. So if you remember kind of the way back in the Joseph story, Judah was a total jerk. Judah, the man, was a total jerk at first with regard to Joseph. And then over the course of the whole Joseph narrative, Judah actually emerges as a pretty good guy. He emerges as this leader of the rest of the brothers. And he's the one who kind of pledges his own life when it comes right down to it with regard to going down into Egypt and then eventually, of course, realizing that Joseph, this man who was so powerful in Egypt, was actually their brother Joseph. So all that to say that early on, Judah as a man emerges as sort of this leader among all of the brothers. He's the fourth son, by the way, not of the favorite wife. He's the fourth son of Leah. And once we get to Genesis 49, that's when Jacob blesses his sons. Even though Joseph is his favorite, the one who gets the longest blessing is Judah. So you see already in the blessing of the sons of Jacob, this prominence that's given to Judah. And then you get to a census in the book of Numbers. Well, who's the most populous of the tribes? Well, it's the tribe of Judah. And so now when we get to chapter 15 of Joshua, who gets the biggest portion of land? Well, it's the tribe of Judah. And this, by the way, happens to be, I think it's 63. Yeah, 63 verses long. Joshua 15 is as long as chapter in the book of Joshua. So in other words, Judah's kind of a big deal. And rightly so, not just because at this point he's a big deal, but because as time goes on, of course, Judah emerges as the preeminent regal tribe of the Israelites. It's going to be Judah that, of course, David comes from, and it is not only the tribe of Judah, but the family of David, that in 2 Samuel 7, you have the very specific promise of the Messiah connected with, where David wants to build a house for God, and God turns around and says, no, 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 I'm going to build a house for you. I'm going to build this regal lineage that's going to culminate in the Messiah. That's a promise that I'm giving to you. So you see, over time, you begin with the guy named Judah, and then you have the tribe named Judah. And then over the course of the Old Testament, pretty much the nation itself is known as Judah, right? In fact, by the time you get to the first century, it's referred to as Judea, which is both connected with the word for Jew as well as Judah himself. So anyway, over time, you have more and more of this focus, this almost like exclusive focus upon the tribe of Judah until finally Christ is born. And of course, Matthew in his opening chapter makes quite a bit about that because he's focusing upon David and that genealogy, and David is from the tribe of Judah. So anyway, that's why Joshua 15 devotes so much time to this particular tribe. And they are going to inherit, if you can kind of picture in your mind, or you can look this up, there's plenty of maps that you can check out that show tribal divisions. But if you're not there, if you're just listening, just kind of picture in your mind how Israel looks. Well, if you take the area from just about the north end of the Dead Sea to the south end of the Dead Sea, and just stretch it across all the way to the Mediterranean, that was the land apportioned to the tribe of Judah. It's a big chunk of land. So all the way from the Jordan River, kind of the top of the Dead Sea to the bottom of the Dead Sea, and then westward all the way to the Mediterranean. So that all that was given to them, it wasn't until, I guess, Solomon's reign before they actually possessed all of it, because you had the strong holdout of the Philistines along the Mediterranean coast in their cities that were, of course, still giving David issues when he became king. But anyway, that was the big swath of land that was given to them. Now, we have one little story here that is, I think, of interest, if nothing else, and kind of humorous tone to it. This is in the middle of the chapter, verses 13 and following. So, well, here's what happens. Caleb does exactly what he said he was going to do in chapter 14. So he goes into the hill country and he captures the city of Hebron. It says he drove out the three sons of Anak, Sheshai, and Ahiman, and Talmai, these three descendants of Anak. Verse 14 says he drove them out. And then it says he went from there to this city called Debir, formerly known as Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb makes his promise. He's like, all right. So he doesn't attack it for whatever reason.
Probably because he's like 80-something years old.
Probably because he's 85, yeah. So he says, I tell you what, God gathers all the guys around. Anybody who takes this city, I've got a prize for you. I'm going to give you my daughter, Aksa, as a wife. So we don't know anything about Aksa at this point, but evidently it was enough motivation for one guy, Othniel. He is Caleb's nephew. So Caleb and Kenaz are brothers, and Othniel is the son of Kenaz. So Caleb's nephew, Othniel, hears this promise, and he's like, all right, challenge accepted. And he goes and he captures this city. And as a result, then Caleb gives Othniel his cousin as a wife. So yep. This is one of those, we were talking about this a little bit before we started the podcast. This is one of those, what to us is rather odd, biblical practices, but it was not uncommon whatsoever in the Bible for people to marry their cousins.
Now, I got two thoughts about this. The first thought is, how old is his daughter at this point? If he's 85...
This is true.
She's like, all right, here's the deal. My 60-year-old daughter who's not hasn't been able to find a husband. Is this what's going on? What is this? This is weird. Does he have like a daughter when he was 65? Like maybe. We don't know.
Maybe.
Don't know. The other thing is that this is just another example of why you need to be really careful with the phrase biblical view of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Which always freaks me out when people say that. I hold to a biblical view of marriage. I'm like, oh, yeah?
Like, well, be careful with that.
Do you have the Old Testament in your Bible? Because it gets a little weird sometimes, man.
It does, yeah. I mentioned to you beforehand that I did not realize this until I was doing some research on this. But, you know, there's lots of prohibitions in the Old Testament. But and I've yet to triple check this, but according to the commentator that I read, it would not be a prohibition of biblical law for a man to marry his niece. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's lots of what to us are very strange marital practices in the Old Testament.
Yeah. Usually when people say biblical view of marriage, they mean one man, one woman for life or whatever, not realizing that biblical view of marriage includes go kill these guys and I'll give you my daughter.
Yeah, right. Yes. So be careful when you use that particular phrase. Yeah. So anyway, that's what happens. They ended up getting some land and some springs on top of, because Oxa is evidently one of these ladies who knows how to get what she wants. So she gets not only the land, but some springs of water out of her dad as a result of this. So you could, it's a short story, but I think it's kind of humorous. It tells us a little bit about the personality of Oxa as well, if you're reading between the lines there. But anyway, that's 40 minutes, and that's two more chapters, 14 and 15. Moving along.
All right. Yeah, man. We are out of time. Guys, we're coming down the stretch for Joshua, and then things are going to get crazy in Judges. Again, thank you so much to all of you who support the podcast. If you would like to join those who have done that, you can go over to 1517, go to the donate page, and you can get that done. I really appreciate it. Chad, we will see you next week.
See you then.